And good morning, Jacksonville. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Dan Scanlon coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT, and we've got another great show for you today, so let us get to it. Today, UNF releases the findings of its latest Jax Speaks poll, and then we'll take a closer look at scenic Jacksonville's fourth annual Great City Symposium. Plus, if you know the joke, you know it. Theater, Alhambra, Legally Blonde opens next week. But first, on Monday, University of North Florida's Public Opinion Research Lab released the results of the Jax Speaks poll, which surveyed respondents on local issues as well as job approval for several of our local politicos. Eva Matthews is here, research coordinator for UNF's PORL, and she has more details. So, hey, Eva.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I am very happy to have you here. I wrote about this earlier this week, and now you out there in listener land can join the conversation. Call us at 549-2937. Tweet us at FCC on air, email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or message us on First Coast Connect on the Facebook pages. Before we discuss the findings, Eva, I'm aware of this. I actually, in my younger days, was a telephone solicitor. But what is the Public Opinion Research Lab, and how do you determine what you ask all these fine folks that you talk to?
Well, the Public Opinion Research Lab is exactly what it sounds like. We do public opinion research at the University of North Florida. We typically do telephone surveys of, in this case, registered voters in Duval County. So that's to answer the first part of your question. We determine what we are asking based on what's happening around. So we, for this particular project, we were just paying attention to what was in the news and saw that there was some talk about the stadium upgrade. So that was sort of what was the impetus for us to do this particular survey at this time.
And then obviously we're in the first few months of our new city leaders. So that was certainly a line of questions to ask.
Absolutely. It was a little early, I think, for Donna Deegan's administration. She just sort of started a little bit ago. She's still within her 100 days. But yes, we did a few job approvals, and we're interested in the results of that.
Who's the person or persons who make the calls? Are they students, or do you get on the phone yourself?
They are mostly students. We do have some non-student community member interviewers. They're excellent, I will say that. We have a very, very talented and well-trained group of students who do our calling, and they know exactly what they're doing and how to best approach a project like this.
And speaking about calling, I would guess that some of these are political science students. I mean, this is what they might be doing someday for pay.
Some of them are, but you'd be surprised. We have majors from all across campus. We have different colleges. So we have some from the business school, some from the College of Health. Everyone's interested in talking to people.
Talking to people. I did once play telephone solicitor, and I must have called zillions of people to get maybe one or two responses. So who's being surveyed, and how do you do it, and how do you end up with those 511 that you ended up getting responses from?
Well, that depends on the survey. In this case, we were interested in surveying the population of registered voters in Duval County. So that's who we're targeting here. And we are using public records to contact these people via phone, and they are randomly selected by computer. And that's what ensures us a representative sample of the population of registered voters in Duval.
And for listeners who may not know, what's the difference between qualitative and quantitative research, and what category did this poll fall under?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there's a little bit of both in survey research. Quantitative research involves, analyzing data, numbers. Qualitative generally is more fluid. It's a little bit more interpretive of words, and you're reading something and you have to interpret it. And we do a little bit of both in these surveys. There are some open-ended responses that we end up having to sort of use our own brains to put into categories ourselves.
So once the random data is collected, do you target specific people if some categories or demographics remain low or unmet?
So there are a couple steps that we do to ensure a representative sample. First, when we are deciding how to sample our respondents, so we stratify them into groups to make sure that we have a geographical representation across states. In this case, we used state house district to make sure that mm-hmm. we have people from all over Duval County. And then we, on the back end, do what's called weighting. So we weight to the demographics of whatever population we're studying, in this case, Duval voters.
So what about what are those state house districts that you used?
That is a good question. I can actually tell you here.
Actually, if you go online to that site, you have the full report on this and many, many tables at the bottom that give you breakouts in case you really want to dig in.
Right. So if you go to our website, unf.edu/coas/Poral, you can find the entire press release with what we call cross tabulations and all of that data, including our very detailed methodological statement that says exactly how the survey was conducted. But in this case, we used House Districts 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17.
Okay. Let's get to the meat of this. Apparently, it looks like there were 17 questions about local issues and lawmakers, and the ones that jumped out to me were about the stadium. And I want to talk about the stadium first. There is currently negotiations about to begin. City Council's hired their negotiator to join in with the mayor and everybody else with the team. And there seems to be some change in the opinion of folks in this poll about who should pay for it. And then there's a change if you say, if you don't pay for it, the Jaguars are leaving. So how do you feel about that now? So let's talk about the Jaguars portion of this and what changes occurred.
Yeah, so we were pretty interested in that, too. We've been polling on this subject in sort of various forms for a while. You know, there have been a few different proposed development projects for the stadium over the last several years. And support for spending public money on the stadium has always been pretty low. There's always been some opposition to spending public funds on that type of thing. But in this survey, we asked in a little bit of a different way. And we did ask that follow-up question that sort of, you know, gave this ultimatum of what if the Jaguars decide to leave if we don't give them the full amount.
And again, let's talk about that. First of all, you asked the question, what about that $1 to $2 billion and whether you'd want to pay as a taxpayer for part of that? So what did that say?
A slim majority said that they don't want to spend any public funds. So we gave a few different options in this case. So we started at sort of the floor with no public funding. You know, the Jaguars can pay for their own stadium upgrades. And then we went up to the deal that's sort of currently on the table with the 50-50 split between the city and the Jaguars, with the city spending around $1 billion of public funds. And so the majority said that they didn't want to spend any. There were some that said that they would spend up, you know, $500 million, $250 million. And it was a pretty small group that said that they would be willing to pay the full billion. I think it was around, it was 6% of people said that they would be willing to foot the entire billion right up front without any threat of the Jaguars leaving.
But then you use the word threat there. If the Jaguars said, you don't give, we're leaving, there was a paradigm shift in opinion. It's like, oh my gosh, don't take my team away. So give me some of those numbers.
Exactly. So once we said that, the tune changed for some people. About 46% of the total sample said that they would be willing to shell out the full billion if it meant the difference between the Jaguars staying in Jacksonville or moving to another city. And about 47% said no, just let them walk.
Interesting. We have this beautiful stadium across the street from WJCT. I look at it every time I go outside for a breath of fresh air, and I don't know if I could live myself without a team here. And I'm not really an NFL fan, but I'll tell you, it's great to have them here. Well, we've got Mark in St. Augustine, and Mark has a specific comment about this. So let's go to you, Mark.
Hey, you know, I read this survey, and I'm just pulling my hair out. I was pretty happy with the way it was sort of trending, that a lot of people said, you know, no, that's too much money, you know, pay for it yourself. And then when I saw that question about, well, if the Jaguars really are serious and really put the screws to you, yeah, we'll give them anything they want. You know, what kind of backbone is that? It's literally drives me crazy. There is no study there is no study out of this 100 studies that have been done over the last 30 years that indicate a professional sports team brings money into a city. It brings money into the city if it goes past Shad Khan's house, but it doesn't, it's not good for the city. And we could spend all that money, you know, people that go to football games, that's discretionary income. And instead of putting it into the Jaguars 12 times a year for mediocre football, we would spend it throughout the entire city all year long. I don't understand how my brothers and sisters in Jacksonville don't understand this. We're being extorted. We're being blackmailed. And this just proves to me, yeah, half the citizens of Jacksonville said, yeah, that's fine by me.
All right. Thank you, Mark. You know, for what it's worth, when you do buy that hot dog or hamburger at the stadium, you are, in fact, helping some of the nonprofit organizations and neighborhood organizations that are in there doing some of the serving. And incidentally, Mark Lamping, a general manager of the team, is out there on the road right now at I think we've got Yulee in Nassau County for a town meeting on Friday night, one of their huddles. So they're reaching out to the neighboring counties to talk about this. Would you ever, Eva, check the surrounding counties for support, since many people bring up the fact that maybe our neighbors should be helping out here?
Well, that's a good point. You know, we haven't before. We've, you know, we've typically, on these particular issues, we have talked to Duval County residents about it, since, you know, we are the ones that are, you know, paying the taxes that will eventually fund these projects. So we haven't yet reached out to people outside of Duval County, but that is a good point, and maybe it's something we should consider.
Well, you know, for years when we had tolls and then they disappeared and tolls were coming back, many people said half of our workforce lives out of Jacksonville, out of Duval County. Maybe they should pay a toll to come in and work. So I guess that's some of the same thing. We've got another Mark in Mayport this time who has a comment. So go ahead, Mark in Mayport.
Hey, good morning. My question is, you know, Shad Khan made $5 billion last year, and we took in as a city, what, $1.5 billion in revenue? Seems to me that ratio should kind of work for paying for the stadium as well.
All right. Thank you for that. There's many folks who point out that some of the newer NFL stadiums are paid for by the teams. Others are paid for in matches. Others are paid for municipally. So what might be the next round of questions, and when might you do it when it comes to the stadium?
That is a good question. You know, I think it probably depends a little on what happens with these negotiations currently sort of happening between Donna Deegan's team and the Jaguars. That might not come to a decision until maybe early next year is what they're saying. But, you know, we will typically do a Jack Speaks survey a couple of times a year. So look forward to another one. We might put another stadium question on there, depending on what's happening around us. We've certainly pulled on it for the last few years. So I wouldn't be surprised to see this pop up again.
You know, we in the media always talk about these polls that are done by you, and we place a lot of emphasis on certain parts of it, but do you think City Hall listens?
I think so. I think, you know, and I think you bring up a good point. These particular issues, like the one at the stadium and a lot of the other things that we talk about in these, especially these sort of more policy focused polls rather than the election ones, you know, we don't, as voters, we don't vote directly on these issues, as we know. We're not going to have a direct say in whether or not the city spends $1 billion on the stadium upgrades. But we do vote for the people who are making those decisions. And hopefully those people are listening. And that's why we do these polls. We want to give, you know, Duval registered voters in this case a voice on something that they might not otherwise have a chance to directly influence.
You know, the most interesting one is, here we had our game this weekend, and 100 people get treated by JFRD, and a fair chunk of those apparently were for heat exposure. And just the week before, one of your questions was regarding that matter. If you ask that question right now of those 511, how would they have responded, having heard that it was a hot time, literally, at our stadium this weekend?
Yeah, and that is really interesting because, like you said, one of our questions was what was the most important thing to people in this deal between the city and the Jaguars? in terms of, you know, what's going to happen. And only 4% of people said that the temperature issues were the most important thing to come out of the deal. The what we call the modal response, or the most frequent response, was the economic benefit to surrounding neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods in the area. So it was pretty surprising to see how few people said the temperature issues, given how much that's been sort of the main complaint. And especially after, you're right, this past game on Sunday, we saw some heat-related injuries, and wondering if that would have been a little bit different if we had fielded the survey after that.
You know, there's another component that could be a good question in the future, and you had mentioned economic impact. What happens when you start building this thing? And, you know, Charlie in Jack's Beach has exactly that question. Good morning, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. When you have this going on, you have to have positions where people earn an income, like journalists and firemen and police and carpenters and plumbers and electricians that have to work on the stadium and build the stadium, and laborers, Uber drivers. And then when you had this when you have the football game, you've got hundreds and hundreds of people that are working at the game. So between the firemen, the carpenters, the plumbers, electricians, the journalists, the police, the firemen, these are jobs. That's where that money goes. It goes to employ people. And I think that's a worthy expenditure for me as a taxpayer. Thank you.
Thank you. And he's right about that. Even if we don't renovate this stadium, there are some, according to the poll the Jags took, there are some structural deficiencies and some issues there that need to be addressed. We've always had bathroom and plumbing issues. So there'll still be a workforce that is digging in and repairing the stadium. And then if we, heaven forbid, lose the Jaguars, we're looking at some college games. Basically, maybe we'll bring in some high school events. Maybe we have a big rock concert, but that's the Gator Bowl, if you're old enough, of old, versus the Everbank Stadium of now. Let's move on here. Let's go to the most important problem in Jacksonville. What might that poll have told? Was it crime? Was it infrastructure? As the mayor's talking about, what was the biggest when it came to those polled about the big problem or biggest problems in Jacksonville?
So we frequently ask this question. We ask it, I think, on every Jax Speaks poll that we do. And for the millionth time running, crime is the top problem facing Jacksonville, according to Duval County registered voters. I think it was 37% of people said crime. And we actually ask this a little bit of a different way the last couple of times. In previous years, we have listed the different categories that they could choose, but we were interested in trying to ask this in an open-ended way so that we could give people the chance to respond freely without any influence whatsoever. And still, crime remains the top choice. In fact, it's changed very little over the last couple of years. And then in second place, a sort of a distant second place, was improving infrastructure. Oh, I'm sorry. It was housing costs was the next highest one, and then followed by improving infrastructure and transportation.
And those are comments that we have talked about on First Coast Connect for quite a while. And when we have our media roundtable, those are the ones that the other journalists talk about. And certainly the mayor herself has been joking about infrastructure. She's well aware of the potholes that are out there. We had the sheriff on yesterday, and we talked about crime and the issues, and 100 plus, a little over 100 homicides so far, almost a 50% rating of solving those. So, but yet the sheriff is asking for more funding for more officers. Now, let's talk about those city leaders. You asked people what they thought of our either newly elected or in-place people. So we have a new sheriff, T.K. Waters, no stranger to that department. Mayor Donna Deegan, brand new at her job. And then Melissa Nelson, our state attorney, who's been there now for a while. So what were some of the thoughts about our city leaders?
Well, so Donna Deegan, first, we'll start with her. She has pretty good approval ratings, especially for someone who's only been in office for a few months. I think the 36% of people who said that they didn't know is pretty telling, that, you know, she hasn't had too much of an opportunity to make a huge impression in terms of things that she's been able to do. But she is still well above water. 47% approve either strongly or somewhat, compared to only 15% who said that they disapprove.
And that 47%, how does that rank with previous mayors that you've surveyed?
It's difficult to say because we've never polled on a mayor approval this early in an administration before. But I did look at what we did for Lenny Curry when he was first elected. It was still about a year out, though. So it's a difficult comparison to make. But that was he also had pretty high approvals. He had a 1 year in, he had 69% approval and 17% disapproval. So he was sort of above water by 52 points compared to Donna Deegan, who in this poll sort of was ahead by 32 points.
Folks, just to remind you, you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. We'd love to hear from you, so give us a yell at 549-2937 or tweet us at FCC on air. We're talking right now about the latest UNF poll and the responses that that poll had. And later we'll be talking about some fun stuff as well. But I love this. What about the jail disrepair issue? We had the 12th inmate at the jail this year pass away over the weekend, and the sheriff's office presented that. They had to change their medical provider after some bad press over the previous one, and an inmate passing away after leaving because they didn't get apparently the drugs they needed. So what did the jail disrepair question have to say?
The jail disrepair question, you know, we asked whether people would support or oppose moving the jail to a different location away from downtown. And that's actually including the jail and the JSO administrative offices. And that would be at a price tag of about $380 million. So we asked this question and 52% said that they support moving the jail either somewhat or strongly, and 40% were opposed.
You know, the current administration office on Bay Street has been there since the 1970s and literally was called such a white elephant at its when it was born that there is the great story of somebody towing a white elephant from a car lot in Arlington and parking it in front a statue. And the John E. Good Correctional Center, named for a late city council member, now known as the Duval County Jail, dates from the 1980s, and it has problems. The sheriff admitted that, obviously. He says the stacked design is not a good design for jail. It should be spread out. The question is, where does it go? And I don't know if that was addressed or maybe a future question. Some are saying it should be next to the courthouse, which would mean it would be somewhere in the La Villa area. Others say that it should go far away, which means next to the prison farm on Lanny Road, far, far on the north side where there is some land. So what about that question of where it goes?
Yeah, I think that is an interesting question. And it will sort of give us a little bit more insight into, I think, the impetus for people sort of saying whether they support or oppose this. We saw a sort of an interesting split here between, the party registration. There was a little bit more support among Republicans for moving the jail to a new location than Democrats. I mean, in both cases, I should say that there was more support than opposition. But that is an interesting thing. And I think finding out why people want to move the jail, you know, is it more investing in a newer facility to increase capacity and address some of these crumbling infrastructure things, or is it to just get them out of downtown? That is an interesting thing that we could probe a little bit more.
Well, newcomers may not realize that City Hall, the jail, and the courthouse are where those lawns are right now along the river. That literally our jail was waterfront property next door to a waterfront courthouse. Actually, that open space used to be the parking lot for the courthouse. Now it's going to become a city marina. We actually had a question yesterday from some folks regarding the jail possibility and move. And apparently City Council President Ron Salem is in favor of moving it. I've toured the place long time ago. One of the callers yesterday said, you should open it up for tours. The sheriff said, that might be an idea. Let people see what's in there. So again, there's another possibility of questions. would you want to see what the jail looks like right now?
Yeah. And I wonder if that would change people's opinions if they could see the state of the building itself. And I do also want to point out that the sort of proposal for moving the jail hypothetically would not happen for another 3 to 5 years. And so there is a plan to renovate the existing structure to address some of the immediate concerns of the buildings. And so that is something important to point out, that this expenditure for moving the jail would be in addition to these sort of interim renovations.
And I did ask the obvious question about a month ago, and they said, Sheriff's Office confirmed it is air conditioned. So the high heat that we had over the summer was not an issue per se. That still means you got a 40-year-old system functioning there. Mike from Twitter says, how does Sheriff Waters get high approval ratings after his comments about Donna Deegan during the campaign and the fact that he says adults doing adult things get adult prizes regarding his disapproval of the adult civil citations? That has been a push by many community leaders, Eva, is adult civil citations would possibly remove some people from the jail by citing them, and they'd have to deal with that out of court. The sheriff's response yesterday was, those arrested on some of those minor things are not a long-term problem in the jail, that they normally get out quickly. So questions about adult civil citations. Has that been yet proposed by UNF in the poll?
It has not. And that might be something to look into in the future. I think it's one of those concepts that might be a little foreign to some people, you know, especially in this particular survey. We're looking at registered voters who are, you know, in some ways active in their community by registering to vote, but they might not be necessarily as plugged in to the goings on in local politics than someone like a likely voter, which is some of our other polls. So that might be a question for some of the a little bit more informed respondents that we sometimes talk to in some of our more election-based polls.
And, you know, but everybody can get a misdemeanor. Everybody can get something that these are. And a lot of folks out there have no criminal record, so they would qualify for a civil citation. The sheriff's response, though, was that they give those people a notice to appear. They get a citation that says you will appear in court to address this issue, so there's no jail time. And he also stated yesterday that many of those people the judge will dismiss once they get to court. So that, again, means that they don't have a record and they don't end up in jail. So that was his response to not doing what we already do in Duval County for teenagers, which our state attorney approves of, the juvenile citations. And many other sheriffs in the state of Florida do adult citations because they need to process people out of their jail system. Clay County currently undergoing a massive renovation of its jail facility. And Sheriff Cook told me she wishes she had much more room. They're even starting to use some of her unused office space for the jail. So that's their situation right there. Putnam County just did jail expansion. So we're not the only jail that's facing issues. And we are pretty much at limit right now.
Right. And if capacity issues are the problem, then, doing something like that might help alleviate that situation and help in the future. Sure.
Now, let's go to another question that you asked that I noticed a shift in change, and that is the Confederate monuments. We have pretty much cleared out the monuments that exist in the park opposite City Hall, but we still have the Confederate monument in the Old City Cemetery, and that was always an issue of folks like Ben Frazier and other community groups who say, move them out. And it is always a topic of discussion during the public comment session at City Council, to the point where sometimes there's so many people commenting that you don't get your 3 minutes, you get a minute or a minute and a half. So with 5 minutes left to go in the show, what about the Confederate monument question? Why did you pose it, first of all?
Well, like you said, it's something that's been an issue, a topic of concern in Jacksonville for a long time, and it's something that always comes up. So we've pulled on it several times, and like you said, there was a little bit of movement this time in the direction of support for removal of the monuments. So this time we had 50% of respondents support either strongly or somewhat removing all Confederate monuments from the city's public spaces, and 42% oppose removing them either strongly or somewhat.
Interestingly enough, we do have funding to remove that. Mayor Curry had some funding, and I do believe Mayor Deegan has promised some money as well. Did anyone seem to know that that funding exists already to get to move these things, even if there's no plan to do something with them?
I'm not sure if we really got a sense of how much people know about the funding issue there. We haven't specifically asked why or why not people either oppose or support. But we do see that there, the last time we asked this of a similar sample of registered voters in 2021, there was a 51% support and 49% opposed. So it's a little bit more on the side of support for removal this time. And it's difficult to know what's causing that movement. But that's something that we can certainly look into in a future survey, exactly getting at why people either support or oppose the removal.
And then again, right now, things are a little quiet about the removal. If there is an issue somewhere, or if we start getting some more garbage, people flying things over our Jaguars games, that could come to the forefront again. So I guess that begs the question. First of all, Scott from Facebook says these UNF studies are among the best public policy tools that we have. And I see you smile at that. So in your opinion, now that we've discussed some of the high points, what was the most interesting finding in the latest UNF poll?
Ooh, well, I think the big story has really been the stadium upgrades. That's sort of been at least what's gotten the most media attention and then the most attention from, folks on Twitter X and other social media.
Which we may have to pay for soon anyway.
Well, there you go. But that is really sort of what people are focused on. I think a lot of people feel the same way as what we've seen in the polls, that they don't want to spend public dollars on a, while it is municipally owned, but it's used, basically almost exclusively for private entity, the Jaguars. And it's not unique to Jacksonville. It's something that I think almost probably every city with an NFL team, especially with one that's municipally owned, a stadium that's municipally owned, has this issue that they have to struggle with. So,
and with 30 seconds to go, do you ever face pushback on these polls from anybody?
Always, yes.
Like who?
people. People tend to want to reject things that they don't agree with. And I understand that it's human nature, but we do get pushback on a lot of things, almost everything. If you don't agree with what the poll says, then I encourage you to go look on our website and look exactly how we conduct these polls, and maybe give you a little bit more confidence in what we're doing.
All right, thank you very much. We've been talking about UNF polls, but we're just getting started, so don't go anywhere. We will be right back. And welcome back. Well, the Great Cities Symposium is coming back to Jacksonville for year number 4, the civic leadership event hosted by Scenic Jacksonville. Its job to educate, inform, and foster community conversations. And the event gives city residents an opportunity to learn from the successes and challenges of peer cities. So A.G. Lafley is the accomplished business and civic leader who's the keynote speaker of the event, and he joins us today by phone. Good morning, A.G.
Good morning.
And I hear you're in a place where we all wish we could be right now.
The mountains. It is a great time of year to be in the mountains.
Okay, I can officially hate you, but still like you for being here. Thank you. Now, you are an extremely accomplished person. You're a CEO, you're a business mentor, a nonprofit leader, an author, and philanthropist. So What are, do you think, some of your greatest achievements as Procter & Gamble's CEO?
Well, first of all of the achievements at P&G, at least when I was there for 36 years, are team and organization accomplishments. I think the biggest thing that the team was able to accomplish in 2000 when we had some real problems was to not just turn around the company, but put it on a path of steady growth, steady value creation, and most importantly, refocusing on serving the consumer. You know, we put the consumer at the center of everything we do. All P&G does is create and offer everyday household and personal care brands that hopefully make your life and other lives a bit better every day. And we just focused on what we do, and we started doing it a little bit better every year, and the results came.
And I should let folks know that you were the CEO, but obviously you're not spending your time just hanging out in the mountains. You've co-authored two books called Playing to Win and The Game Changer. So what can a reader expect when they read those? What do they learn from these?
Well, the first book we did was Game Changer. My co-author was Ram Charan, who's far better known than I am in the world of business and business advising and consulting. And the focus of that book was innovation. And the basic thesis was that for most companies, innovation is important, okay? And what we tried to dig into was a very practical approach to an innovation strategy and, more importantly, innovation practice, whether you're at a very small business or whether you're at a mid-sized or a large business. So it was kind of a how-to-do book, how to do innovation and why it's important.
And then the second book there, again, trying to educate, trying to help people get their businesses off the ground and stay off the ground?
Playing to Win. Playing to Win was, again, a very practical, pragmatic approach to business strategy that we'd actually experimented with and practiced for almost 20 years at P&G, and we felt that it was, again, reapplicable to businesses of all sizes, but also to nonprofits, to government, and even to freelancers starting up their own business. And there are now 70 million freelancers in America. But it was, again, a practical how-to approach. And it's been amazing. We've sold hundreds of thousands of copies of that book, published by the Harvard Business Press, and it continues to sell. And I think it sells because it's accessible, it's easy to understand, and frankly, it's relatively easy to do.
Well, you're a consultant. My late father spent many decades as a hotel executive, and when he consulted after retirement, that was his job, to help you keep your hotel not only succeeding, but innovative. So what do you primarily consult on?
Actually, I'm spending more time today advising and consulting startups, early stage companies, and nonprofits that I care about very much. Some of it is, how shall I say, official. In other words, I'm an investor, I'm on the board, whatever. Some of it is on request. I don't do it for a living. If somebody pays me anything, we gift it all away. But it, I'm not headed to the golf course. I'm with Mark Twain. Golf is a good walk ruined. My hobbies, my way of having fun is, helping businesses and helping organizations and helping communities achieve their goals.
Well, it sounds like it really drives you to do this because it's an avocation, not a vocation. So why is it important to you to help?
Well, it's interesting. I've been asked this question many times regarding Cincinnati and regarding Sarasota and the Bay Project in Sarasota and the Center City Development in Cincinnati. And there are multiple motivations, right? And in Cincinnati, the city was in pretty desperate straits, and we had to do something. So there was what's in the best interest of the city. And by the way, P&G has been headquartered in the city of Cincinnati since 1837. So we had a company stake in the success of the city, self-interest there. And then there's also, the altruistic motives. I've always believed that part of my responsibility is to give back to the communities and cities in which I live, we live and work. And it's, part of my life. A healthy city makes for a healthy community, makes for, a healthy neighborhood and makes for healthy companies.
And, the Bay Project is certainly being pointed to as something that they want to duplicate along the Emerald Trail in places here in Jacksonville. So let's meld into the Great City Symposium and what it is and what we might hear from you and others.
Well, I think they're interested in understanding experiences from other cities that are relevant and potentially important as Jacksonville works through, their decisions, their strategies, and their redevelopment of their downtown and their waterfront. The Bay is a fairly discrete, well-defined waterfront development. It's 53 acres owned by the city of Sarasota. It was frankly underused, underdeveloped, and underplanned, but it's fairly discrete. It's like a waterfront in any other city. It's like the waterfront development, the riverfront development in Cincinnati. Just a contrast, Cincinnati was more of a total urban revitalization and renewal effort. So we had to work at the core of downtown. We worked in all the adjacent districts and neighborhoods, and we included a major riverfront development. So coming back to Sarasota, there are lots of Florida similarities. Working in Florida is different in some ways than working in other states. There is the gift of the waterfront, which is it's a resource that ought to be taken advantage of. And what's required is a strong private-public partnership between whatever entity is going to do the private development and the city. And that's incredibly important, that partnership.
Well, our Emerald Trail is going to obviously utilize creekfront as well as other natural beauty that's maybe been hidden by some old warehouses. Have you been to Jacksonville so that you have an idea of what waterfront and what possibilities could exist when we're talking about renaturalizing, redeveloping?
I have been to Jacksonville several times. I will admit St. Augustine is one of our favorite getaways, so we do often stay there. And I'll also admit that I get my annual physical at the Mayo Clinic. So I have seen downtown. I have been to the Jacksonville Jaguars Stadium. I have seen the football game they call the greatest cocktail party on earth between the University of Florida and the University of Georgia. Once was enough. So I have some idea. And I'm going to come in early and walk some of the development that's going on right now with the team. So
just quickly, we got 30 seconds left. I hate to interrupt the CEO, but where and when is the Great City Symposium?
The symposium is October the 4th. It's at the Garden Club. I believe the evening begins at 5:30, and I will do a brief presentation and encourage a dialogue with lots of Q&A.
Well, thank you very much. You're going to be on the riverfront right there. This is Dan Scanlon. We're listening to First Coast Connect. Don't touch the dial. We will be right back right after this.
Amelia Island brings all styles of jazz to the Les DeMerle Amelia Island Jazz Fest, October 1st through 8th. Celebrate the pop vocal group Manhattan Transfer performing on October 5th. Info at ameliaisland.com/jazz. Scenic Jacksonville presents the Great City Symposium, October 4th. A.G. Laffley, former CEO of Procter & Gamble, shares how he led the revitalization of downtown Cincinnati and the Sarasota Bay waterfront. Tickets at scenicjacksonville.com. WinGuard, a local marketing and communications agency that develops websites designed to attract and engage customers. Launching or refreshing a website can give local companies an edge over their competition. Now celebrating its 15th year, WindGuard is proudly located in Five Points and serves client partners across Northeast Florida. More information on WindGuard's website design and development services can be found at wearewindguard.com.
WJCT Public Media invites you to an evening with Amna Nawaz, co-anchor of the PBS NewsHour. Amna Nawaz will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, on stage for an enlightening and engaging conversation. Tuesday, October 3rd at WJCT Studios. VIP reception is at 6 p.m., followed by the presentation at 7. For tickets and more info, go to wjct.org/events.
New apartments are being built at a rate not seen for nearly half a century, but the construction of other alternatives to single-family homes has stood still. President Biden now wants to change that. Next time on 1A, we hear why some states have effectively shut down the supply of duplexes and other multifamily units, and how the lack of what's called middle housing is preventing so many from getting a foothold in the property market.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hey, welcome back. Well, the 2007 musical Legally Blonde opens at the Alhambra Theater, September 28th and runs through November 5th. The show tells the story of Elle Woods, a sorority girl who enrolls at Harvard Law School to win back her ex-boyfriend. And, you know, sitting with me right now is the guy in charge, Craig Smith, managing partner, and his public relations guy, Mark Berman, of the Alhambra Theater. Now, I'll tell you, I have been in this market for a long time, and I remember the chef, the buffet, the stage rolling back in, the creamed something or other that was like lobster Newberg, but it wasn't. My wife just saw Teviev. She just loved it. I didn't get a chance to get out. I had someplace else to go. So this is a legendary music theater that's been around forever. And at one point, it was like one of only 19 left in the country, I think. I remember that number. So first of all, let's just talk to Craig. It's been a while since you've been here. So what's the overview of how the theater's going? I drive by it all the time. It is jam-packed in the parking lot, morning, noon, night. You tell me.
And we've been so fortunate. You just depicted a correct scenario. We have been full all season. Most of our shows have been 90%+. And it's hard to believe that just 3 years ago, I didn't know if it would survive, you know, with all that was going on in the world and the fact that a lot of folks get together in a small space and stay together for a long time. But folks have been coming this year. We had Jersey Boys and we had Beauty and the Beast and just a lot of great shows that folks wanted to come see. Legally Blonde is 89% sold as we sit, and we're a week to go before opening. So it'll be a sold out show by the time we open.
And you're now a sit-down dinner with a choice of goodies. And I know at one point there was a pretty famous chef involved with the food. But
Chef Roy is still with us. Chef Cadillac, who you recall waving the
napkin. Oh, yes.
That pomp and circumstance. That was the best as a young man. That was best going there and watching that stage roll out. We spent a fortune to make the stage roll out 13 years ago when I bought the place. And a year in, I said, you know what? People are going to like it better if they get to sit down and be served. And we stopped using the stage, much to my chagrin, but people love it. And really, it increased our attendance dramatically. People really like the table service and being able to sit down and feel like they're in a fine dining establishment.
Well, if it's doing so good, why do you need the PR guy?
Because he's been with me since the beginning. I couldn't do without him. I'm involved in another company, and he's with me there as well. So we've been together a long time.
So let's talk about Legally Blonde here.
Can I answer that question?
All right, go for it.
Because you don't need me as a PR guy, but it's amazing to me, particularly as Jacksonville's grown and there are so many new people in town that don't know the theater, right? That haven't grown up with the Alhambra, right? So our job as a theater, the experience, you know, my job, whoever's job as the PR person, is to let the rest of the world know about this theater and how cool it is and how interesting it is and iconic it is.
And the word does go out. I mean, I see the ads, I see the emails, I see the promotions, it's just, we certainly know. And what I noticed the most is you are very rapidly changing these shows. These are not here for a long run. And now we've got Legally Blonde, which I can think of only as a movie. Oh yeah, there was a musical. So Legally Blonde, who's in it and what?
So we brought in a young lady named Tori Vegassi, and I'm always afraid I'm going to say it wrong. She was a semifinalist on America's Got Talent with Simon Cowell and Howie Mandel.
She has some pipes.
And she's got some great pipes. She's a great performer. And she might have would have done better on that show, America's Got Talent. Howie Mandel kind of early on decided that she wasn't going to win, and he would say it about every broadcast. And, yep. And so ultimately she didn't, but she was a semifinalist and did a great job.
So interesting point on Howie, and I just read this while I was doing my homework on her. So she went the furthest of her season, which was season 16 in 2021, of anyone to get a no vote. And Howie was the only one to no vote her. Really? Everybody else gave her the yes vote, and she was the only one to get to the semifinals.
He just never was a big fan. But so we're excited to have her. We got a great cast with the show. It's a fun show. It's a little... it's more adultish than some people might think, particularly, you know, that crew that's 30 to 50. It's right in their wheelhouse. They're going to love it. Bunch of good humor. You know, a buddy of mine said, it's a little girl show. I said, no, I assure you it's not. We had to, you know, maybe tighten up a spot or two just in case any families did come. So.
Well, here we are talking about how well it's doing now, but again, I remember when it literally was one of the last of its kind in the world. And apparently back in 2009, you had to almost give tickets away. Now we've got something called the After Dark Music Series, which sounds like a no-brainer. Let's talk about that in the next minute or so we got left.
Dan, we've been so fortunate. My brother does a great job finding these bands for us. And this week we're doing Elvis. We did a Karen Carpenter Monday night. So they're typically one or two night shows. Sometimes we'll keep them four or five nights, like with the Elvis show, because they sell so well. But it's really been a game changer in our deal. You know, because in our business, you can come six times a year, eight times a year and see the shows. By having the music series, you might come a dozen times a year because there's that many other acts that you wanted to come.
Hey, the Florida Theater was smart. After COVID allowed us to start going back in, they brought in a singer and a cover band. They brought in cover bands. They brought in that Fleetwood Mac group. So I understand. Okay, we're talking about the Alhambra. Go check it out. They're on the website. And that's our program. So thanks to all of our guests and callers. Executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Producer Stacy the Brain Bennett. Associate producer Kathy Waterman. Our director, the Spielberg of the operation, Brad Corum. I could not do this without them, so thank you guys. Our theme music performed by Club de Belugas. Got questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Dan Scanlon. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. Remember, keep your heart open for Duval and each other, and we'll be talking every day at 9 a.m. Ciao.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.